Good morning. So I will be honest right up front. I am wildly excited to talk to you. This is a subject that I love. At the same time, I wish that I had millions or billions of years, but who has that kind of time? I only have an hour. And so we are going to move as fast as I can. And I'm just trusting God to say what he wants to say. I want you to hear from him, not from me. I want to start by talking about this stage. Why this stage? So when we talked about doing this apologetic series many months ago, I thought about, you know, I've talked about creation other times. I've gotten to talk to a group at Georgia Tech about it, and I've gotten to talk to some youth groups and things like that. But I don't want this to be academic. I want this to be intimate and personal as we talk about our Creator. And so when I think about the concept of creation, and when I walk around in this gorgeous world with trees and animals and sun and stars and rivers and all of that, as an engineer, it fascinates me, the majesty of the designer of all of it. And one of the things, and I'll get to this in this presentation, that underpins my confidence in my Creator is the relationship between a designer and design, the relationship between a building and a builder, and the relationship between an artist and art. So these paintings on the stage, you can enjoy them without knowing the artist. You can. But you'll enjoy them more if you know the artist, okay? And I know who these people are because the artist, Elena Delgado, told me who they were. I cannot figure that out from this painting alone. I needed to know the artist to know that. And I want you to think about these things as I go through the, you know, we're going to talk about inverse cube functions and things like that so we can get lost in some math and all that. But I want you to remember more than anything that where there's an artist, where there's art, there's an artist. I want you to remember that where there's a building, there's a builder. I want you to remember that where there's a design, there's a designer. And I also want you to remember and think about that this painting knows nothing of its painter. This painting is two-dimensional. This painting knows nothing of being three-dimensional, and it cannot. This painting is constrained in ways that its painter is not. If this painting were to try to understand its origin within the scope of all that it knows, the paint, the wood, it would never figure it out. It couldn't. This painting is incapable of understanding its origin. It cannot, because it is much less than its creator. It is much less than the painter. And, you know, when I thought about today, the one thing and the thing that led me to ask Elena to bring these was that I want you to know the artist. That's it. Whether you believe in creation or not, I do think if you don't believe in it, it makes it hard to know your God. It can completely obscure your God. But I truly believe that if you believe, if anyone believes that all that we see just happened by chance, and I don't believe that that's a rational view, and I'll talk about why, but if you believe that, I believe that it takes the beauty and the color out of everything. So I want you guys to get to see that beauty today. So I'm going to do my best. One slide I didn't put in here was one that said to be continued. We may need that. But I want to read you some scripture before we get started. And this is weird for me, not weird, but I love coming up here and teaching the Bible. I love it. And I'm going to read you a few scriptures, and that's the last you're going to hear of that today. We're going to be talking about a lot of other stuff. So, first of all, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And we think about that when we think about creation. But what I want to remind you of, if you don't know it already, is that the Bible is full from end to end of God saying, I created you. I'm your creator. I formed you in your mother's womb. I put the stars in the sky. It is full of that. It's not one verse at the beginning, all right? So that's the first. At the end of the Bible, Revelation, you are worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they exist and were created. So from Genesis to Revelation, and I want to read one section. It's a bit long, but I want to read this. I want to read this, and then I'm going to move into the reasons that I believe that creation is a rational way to look at the world around us. I want, if you are a Christian and you're embarrassed about the idea of creation, I want you to be proud about it. And if you don't believe in God at all, and it's because you believe that everything, we're just here by chance, I want to make you reconsider that. And I'll say this, if you're a Christian and you try to fit the Bible into an evolutionary worldview and try to make it fit, and there are efforts to do that, you don't have to do that. It's not necessary. I just want to encourage you to that. But let me read this one section. And I'm reading, so I read from Genesis, I read from Revelation. Isaiah is right smack in the middle of the Bible. I want to read you from that real quickly. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth. By the way, that was written back when we still thought the world was flat and not round. And its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. He brings the princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth useless. Scarcely shall they be planted. Scarcely shall they be sown. Scarcely shall their stock take root in the earth, when he will also blow on them and they will wither. And the whirlwind will take them away like stubble. To whom then will you liken me? Or to whom shall I be equal? Says the Holy One. Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these things. Who brings out their host by number and calls them by name? By the greatness of his might and the strength of his power, not one is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my just claim is passed over by my God? Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the weak and to those who have no might. He gives strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fail. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. And I will get to a slide about why I believe evolution is believed. But one of the biggest reasons I believe is because, and one of the reasons I know I cannot come up here today and resolve this debate, is because this is not an intellectual issue. This is a spiritual issue that goes very, very deep. And so I'm going to jump into this, though, because I do want to get into, as an engineer, I'm one person. I'm giving you my view on these things. As an engineer, as a person who loves science, I'm gonna walk you through some things. So here we go. Here we go. Buckle your seatbelts. So we talked about what is truth last week. We're doing evidence for creation this week, then evidence for the resurrection, and then Easter Sunday. That's where we are in the calendar. So my purpose, as I said before, is not specifically to get you to believe in creation. It's I want you to know the artist. That's the end goal. If you just believe, my dad, he died a few years ago. He was 90 years old when he died. He was an engineer. He was had a master's from Georgia Tech in aerospace engineering. He was also a doctor and a great, great dad. But he did not accept Jesus until he was 90 years old. But all along, as we would talk about creation, evolution, as we would talk about things and Jesus, he struggled with the idea that Jesus was the only way, but he, as an engineer, he said, there's no way this all just happened. He didn't believe in Jesus as his savior, but he looked at the world around him and he said, as a thinking person of science, I cannot accept the fact that this happened by accident. And that's where he was. And then he met the artist when he was 90. So let me read this. Nothing has brought me, this is my personal statement, nothing has brought me more purpose, peace, passion, joy, stability, and hope in my life than knowing my creator. I want that for you guys. Again, this is not about passing a test on science. It's ultimately about knowing the one who made you and who made everything around you. So I am going to share a few videos from this documentary. And so it's a documentary about intelligent design. I won't go into it any more than that, but just I'm going to share three slides. So this kind of jarring sort of slide will come up three times. I couldn't put a different thumbnail on it.
It is completely right to say that since the evidence for evolution is so absolutely, totally overwhelming, nobody who looks at it could possibly doubt that if they were sane and not stupid. So the only remaining possibility is that they're ignorant, and most people who don't believe in evolution are indeed ignorant.
But the people I spoke with weren't ignorant. They were highly credentialed scientists. So there had to be something else going on here.
So you think the whole theory of evolution is false, or just certain parts of it?
Well, again, evolution is a slippery word. I would say minor changes within species happen. But Darwin didn't write a book called How Existing Species Change Over Time. He wrote a book called The Origin of Species. He purported to show how this same process leads to new species. Every species. And the evidence for that grand claim is, in my opinion, almost totally lacking.
Okay. So one thing I want to say...
It is completely right to say that since the evidence...
There we go. I do not believe Richard Dawkins is stupid. I believe he's quite brilliant, and I believe that he is created in the image of God, as we are. He makes another claim in that video where he says that there is not one shred of evidence for the Judeo-Christian God. The irony of that, is that Richard Dawkins is evidence for the Judeo-Christian God. I find that ironic, but he is. And I'm going to talk about why that's true as we go through this. And I do not expect you to read this. I have violated every principle of PowerPoint slides in some of these, so please do not. But I wanted to make one comment. The idea that, and this is something that can intimidate Christians, is the idea that if you believe in creation, you're stupid. You're ignorant, right? The man, Dr. Francis Collins, who led the Human Genome Project that finally defined the entire human genome, is a Bible-believing Christian that's proud of his faith, okay? He's not stupid. And on that slide, people from science professor at MIT, nanotechnology experts, head of the Department of Astronautics and Aeronautics at MIT, the person who led the team of scientists that developed the COVID mRNA vaccine, these are Christians. These are people who believe the Bible, believe creation. And I just want you to know they're out there. If you think, sort of like if you're hiding in a cave, like the prophet Elijah, thank you, thinking that you're the only one, you're not, okay? And these guys, Isaac Newton, Michael Faraday, Louis Pasteur, Johann Kepler, Robert Boyle, I put them up there, but I wanted you to see people on the previous slide who came after Darwin, okay? Some people might say, well, yeah, but if these guys had been around when Darwin was there, then they would have changed their mind. So anyway, I want to read you four quotes that I call honesty from evolutionists. I find these fascinating. Evolution is unproved and unprovable. We believe it only because the alternative is special creation, and that is unthinkable. This is Sir Arthur Keith, who wrote the foreword for the 100th anniversary of Darwin's book, Origin of Species. Evolution is accepted by zoologists not because it has been observed to occur or can be proved by logical, coherent evidence, but because the only alternative is special creation, and that is clearly incredible. This is from Professor D.M.S. Watson, an evolutionary scientist who died in 73. I suppose the reason that we leapt at the origin of species was because the idea of God interfered with our sexual mores. Sir Julian Huxley, a very, very well-known evolutionist of his time. Last one. The more one studies the paleontological record, the more certain one becomes that evolution is based on faith alone. Professor Lewis T. Moore in The Dogma of Evolution, and he's an evolutionist. So, this is what I believe. These are three strong reasons I believe many people believe in evolution. And I'm trying to lay the background. I will get into evidence for creation, but I want to lay the background because this is not simply an intellectual debate. I truly believe personally that the evidence is so strong for creation that aside from the spiritual and other influences, there wouldn't be an argument. So, number one, why do people believe evolution so readily? It is taught as fact, not as a theory, in public schools from the earliest ages. And that's another reason. I don't look at somebody and say, if you believe in evolution, you're ignorant. I don't believe that. I believe that if I was taught something from the very early ages, and people will say, yeah, Paul, you were a Christian. You grew up as a Christian, so you were taught something. That's why, you know, your bias makes you believe this. Several of the people on the slide that I put up first that were on those that very first slide of Christians that are highly, highly esteemed in the scientific world for their contributions, several of them became Christians in college as they studied. They were atheists when they went in. And that's interesting. You know, we worry about sometimes kids getting out of church and going and becoming atheists. And several of those scientists were atheists and became believers in Christ as they looked at the overwhelming evidence of the creation around them. So my point is, this is a big one. If you're taught this as a fact from the youngest ages, it's very logical that you will believe it without examining it throughout your life. Number two, this is a biggie. And if we think about we talk a lot about science and faith and all that, man, I tell you what, science is nothing but the amazing journey of discovering God's creation. That's what science is. That's what it is. And in the process, learning about Him. That's what it is. There is zero incongruity between my faith and science. There's none. Science does nothing but strengthen my faith. Science does nothing but reinforce my faith. And I believe, I was going to say that, you know, I'm not going to come here and debunk, you know, solve this evolutionary debate. And I won't today. But I was going to say, you know, that debate's going to go on until, you know, this life is over, but I'm not sure it will. I really do believe that the because we now can see inside the cell, and we'll talk about that. Once we were able to see inside the cell, the Darwinian evolutionary theory began to really, really, really weaken. Prior to that, it depended on imagining what was in the cell and imagining it to be incredibly simple. That's Darwinian evolution depends on things being so simple at the cellular level that they could happen by chance. And what we found is that they are anything but that. So I don't know where I was going with that. But anyway, what I was going to say is in the scientific method, the idea is that we observe and we test and we validate, right? I want to make something very, very clear. You cannot recreate evolution or creation in a lab. You cannot do it. It is impossible. All right? You can't. I can't walk in a lab and say, let there be light. Why? Because I'm not God. An evolutionist cannot walk into a lab and see millions or billions of years of their proposed slow changes. What we do and how we use science is we look at the world around us and how it works, and we're going to do that. We're getting there. And say, does this match the idea of evolution, long, slow changes over time, depending on errors, mutations, depending on things going wrong to get it right? Do we believe that what we see in the fossil record, in biology, at the cellular level, does that match the story of evolution? Or does it match the story of creation? That's what we're going to talk about. That is a matter of proving beyond reasonable doubt a truth. When somebody goes into a courtroom to try to prove that somebody killed somebody, they use forensic science to look at what is most probably what happened, but they can't recreate the crime. It's over. The person's dead. They're gone. They can't. They do their very best with the evidence available to assess what most likely happened. And that's what we do. No evolutionist, no creationist can go back and make creation happen or evolution happen. You can't do it. You look at what we have today and you make the most rational decision with what you see to be true today. So, problem is, and let me ask you this, if I told you, I want you to imagine this, that 6 hours ago, I was in California, okay? And I had to rush to get here, but I made it. Maybe I need seven hours, I don't know. I was in California. And I asked you all to come up with a theory of how I got here. And I think I can guess what every one of you is thinking, but I want to tell you something. There's some rules. You are not allowed to use air travel as an option. That's out. You have to explain how I got here without that answer, okay? That is clearly incredible. Air travel is clearly incredible. That is unthinkable. So now I want you to think about a theory for how I got here. Now you can imagine how hard and how odd your theory is going to be when before you begin to ask how I got here, you rule an answer out, and actually the answer. And God, special creation, is ruled out because it's not part of our natural world. I'm not ashamed that I believe in a God who said, let there be light. Like I said, the connection between creation and creator, art and artist, building and builder, is everywhere. It's everywhere. It's absurd for me to look at a building and say, I question whether anyone built it. That's just absurd. A five-year-old, and I'll show you a picture in a minute, a five-year-old walking on a beach that sees a sandcastle knows somebody made it. They just do. It's just, you don't have to teach them that. And ironically, if I were to show you a model of a solar system up here and suggest to you that no one made it, you and evolutionists would say I was insane. But they would say that the solar system it represents happened by accident. No one designed it. It doesn't make any sense. But when you rule God out, when you rule the answer out before you ask the question, you're going to struggle to get an answer. And finally, third reason I believe is that creation implies a creator, which implies accountability. Now, very quickly, I'm just going to show this slide because there's 100 examples like this. But I think God has given us hints in a lot of different ways just to remind us that he did this. So if you take a spinning object and spin it fast enough that it fragments, the objects that fly off of it will spin the same direction. It's called conservation of angular momentum. Two of our planets do not. Uranus and Venus defy that, okay? And I think that's just God being creative in putting them in a way that doesn't make any sense with the idea of things happening naturally, right? This is just a picture of the distance of the moon from the Earth. And we could debate all day about the age of the Earth. I do believe it's very young. I believe in seven literal days of creation and all that. And we won't get in. We won't go down that rabbit trail right now. But if the Earth were billions of years old, the moon, at the rate that it's moving away from Earth right now, would be half the distance from the Earth, which means when you look at the the tides are inversely proportional to the distance of the moon. They're inversely proportional to the cube of the distance, and so they would be, the tides would be 8 times greater, which would just wipe things out constantly. The reason I mentioned just those two quickly, because that's not where I'm going to focus my attention, is that there are dozens and dozens and dozens, and I kind of started out this with thinking I was going to go through a litany of those kind of examples, but I just want you to know they're there, and they're everywhere. They're not hard to find. But these are the four things I want to concentrate on, and I have no idea if I can get to the end of this. But I want to concentrate on evident design. In other words, just the fact that you see design everywhere, okay? That's the first thing. And these are sort of in order of me telling you, when I just look around me, why I believe that there is a creator, that this was created and didn't happen. The first thing is just the evidence of design, and I cannot separate design from designer. I just can't do it. Number two, irreducible complexity. Basically, what that means is that you cannot take a complex system and remove any of it, very many of its parts, and have it still work, much less most of its parts. It cannot get to a place of functionality unless it's all there to begin with, okay? We know that. We know that from life. When I was thinking about this, my daughter's car got an engine code and it stopped running, right? Because one sensor in her car wasn't working, right? One sensor stopped her car from working. I didn't order the part and keep driving the car because the car was going to work fine and I was just going to upgrade it to a new sensor. The car stopped working. And everything around us works that way. Complex systems, be they computers or cars or watches or whatever, you take a few pieces out and they don't work. So that's irreducible complexity. Second law of thermodynamics, we'll get to it. Fossil record, I don't know if we'll get to it. But the fossil record wildly supports creation, wildly supports the flood. It does terrible damage to evolution. And so I hope we get to it. But let's start here with evident design. No 5-year-old on the planet would think that that happened by accident, right? They wouldn't. None of us would. And we take that for granted. We take our ability to distinguish natural causes from design, we take it for granted. We see it everywhere. I've said this already, but I'm going to say it again. Where there is design, there's a designer. Where there is a building, there's a builder. And where there's a painting, there's a painter. I just believe that. I just can't accept the fact that everything on this stage just happened. I can't. The moment I see any of this, I want to meet the artist. And I find meeting the artist better than looking at the art. I find that to be true. I'm just showing you a few extra examples. When you look at this rock formation, you probably notice something in there that suggests somebody did something that wasn't natural, right? When you look at these flowers, which by themselves are a work of art by our God, you notice something that probably did not happen over time naturally. When you look at that, I hope you realize that the chance of that happening, one of the things I love, one of the things, and I haven't heard whether evolutionists have a view on this. The idea of evolution is natural selection, right? It's that things needed to be better, that mutations happen, and therefore problems are solved. In my life, problems are never solved by things going wrong. But here's the thing: an evolutionary worldview is very much based on what's needed, just what's needed. Beauty is not necessary. Beauty isn't necessary, and yet it's all around us. Color, beauty, design. you know, we don't need all the variations of fruit, you know, and food that we have. All that. That's not necessary. There's no biological need for the variety and the beauty and the smells and the tastes and the aromas. None of that's necessary. I don't see how you explain that in a evolutionary view. You know, looking at the beauty of these structures and how these structures work is wildly complex. How photosynthesis works is wildly complex. It is not simple. And I don't know if... Okay, so that's our cat. And again, I can't look at that face and think that that happened by accident. I just can't. Okay, so again, for me, I could stop almost right here and just say, the intricacy, the beauty, the complexity around me just suggests a creator. I'm just more comfortable with that. I'm not comfortable from just a pure rational standpoint believing that hearing and all the mechanics that are needed for that, the bones, the tiny bones, all the things, the nerves, the neurons, everything, that happened by accident, that the eye happened by accident. So that's really what I want to say about the issue of the majesty of design around us. We just see it everywhere. But I want to talk about irreducible complexity. I'm going to spend the most time on this, and this is where it'll get the most intense, I guess. Let me start here. This is Darwin's Origin of Species. Most people are familiar with that title. I don't think everybody's familiar with the subtitle, Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. That probably doesn't surprise anybody. But the subtitle that's interesting, and I think in later copies they took this off. I'm not positive, but I don't think it's on later copies. Or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. That's a pretty important nuance that's kind of hidden there on the title of that book. And, you know, I think that, again, the reason that the debate in creation and evolution, this kind of goes back to that first statement that I made about that creation suggests a creator and accountability. Man has a tendency to want to be the favored race, to want to be favored, to want to be at the top of the food chain, quote unquote. And a creator is very threatening to that. So I just wanted you to see that. Now I want you to see something that's super important, okay? This next slide, I want to read this, and I want you to keep this in mind as we look at multiple examples of irreducible complexity. This is a statement that Charles Darwin made, and I am so thankful he made it in this book, okay? If it could be demonstrated that he didn't say some or most or all, although he could have. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. I love that he said that. Because what we have discovered since Darwin and since the advent of an electron microscope is that, in fact, no organ exists, no complex organ exists, that can be created by successively small steps. The resolution of microscopes back then was very bad. You couldn't see finer details like viruses or molecular structures. That's a key. Darwin's work relied more on macroscopic observation of organisms and their traits rather than microscopic details. So I want to talk to you about this. I'm going to try to read two things to you today. I hope, I just feel like I need to read this to you. I'm not going to try to summarize it. Michael Behe wrote Darwin's Black Box, and the point of this is, and again, I think Darwin was a smart man. He observed these finches and how their beaks changed. I mean, he was a smart man, and he proposed a theory But he also qualified his theory saying, if you could prove this, my theory would be wrong. His theory has taken on a life of its own, and it is, now that we have opened the black box is the cell. The black box is the things he couldn't see with his microscope, but that box has now been opened. So let me read this real quick to you. We humans tend to have a rather exalted opinion of ourselves, and that attitude can color our perception of the biological world. In particular, our attitude about what is higher and lower in biology, what is an advanced organism and what is a primitive organism, naturally starts with the presumption that the pinnacle of nature is ourselves. The presumption can be defended by citing human dominance and also with philosophical arguments. Nonetheless, other organisms, if they could talk, like this flagellum, could strongly argue for their own superiority. This includes bacteria, which we often think of as the rudest forms of life. And again, what I'm trying to show you in some of these things is the smallest, simplest things that we know of, okay? And that's the issue. They don't get simpler. And that's the problem, is they're not simple enough to function without being complete. Some bacteria boast a marvelous swimming device, the flagellum, which has no counterpart in more complex cells. In 1973, it was discovered that some bacteria swim by rotating their flagella. So the bacterial flagellum acts as a rotary propeller, in contrast to the cilium, which acts more like an oar. The rotary nature of the bacteria flagellar motor was a startling, unexpected discovery. Unlike other systems that generate mechanical motion, muscles, for example, the bacterial motor does not directly use energy that is stored in a carrier molecule such as ATP. Rather, to move, the flagellum uses the energy generated by a flow of acid through the bacterium membrane. The requirements for a motor based on such a principle are quite complex and are the focus of active research. A number of models for the motor have been suggested. None of them are simple. The flagellum uses a paddling mechanism. Therefore, it must meet the same requirements as such other swimming systems. Because the bacterial flagellum is necessarily composed of at least three parts, a paddle, a rotor, and a motor, it is irreducibly complex. It cannot function without one of those. Gradual evolution of the flagellum, like the cilium, faces mammoth hurdles. The general professional literature on the bacterial flagellum is about as rich as the literature on the cilium, with thousands of papers published on the subject over the years. That isn't surprising. The flagellum is a fascinating biophysical system, and flagellated bacteria are medically important. Yet, here again, the evolutionary literature is totally missing. Even though we are told that all biology must be seen through the lens of evolution, no scientist has ever published a model to account for the gradual evolution of this extraordinary machine. Okay, and that obviously is a simplification of what's really happening there, just to try to make it look understandable to us. All right, I want to read you this. This came across, and then I'll be done reading to you. This came across my view, and I found it, I don't even know how I came across this, but it was recent. I guess just because as I was preparing and stuff, maybe I was, you know, if you say the word creation and your phone hears it, you're going to get all sorts of advertisements for creation. So, but anyway, I found this article, and I find it fascinating. We built the world's simplest cell, but don't know how it works. And this was written April 21st of 2016 and published in National Geographic, okay? So I want you to hear this article. I'm going to read most of it, not all of it. And I'm going to point out some words, the way words are used. It's quite interesting. A lot of times in talking about evolution, you'll find people talking about design, intent, in evolution, right? You'll hear words that really don't refer to natural, undirected processes. They will use words that define, that only could apply to intelligence, intent, purpose, direction when trying to talk about an undirected process, and you'll see some of that in here. The idea was daring, radical, dangerous even. Is it possible to build a living organism from scratch? Now, right off the bat, If you guys hear from scratch, I don't know what you think, but I think from nothing, right? That's clean sheet of paper, right? From scratch. That, keep that word in mind. Build a living organism from scratch. That caught my attention. I'm like, wow, have we done it? Because there have been experiments to try to create life. This idea that there was primordial soup and we had these basic elements, and there have been many experiments to try to shock and send electricity into things, and we haven't been able to do it. So I thought, wow, maybe I missed it. Maybe in 2016, we created life. So I kept reading. Is it possible to build a living organism from scratch that's smaller, simpler, more bare bones than anything now alive? Can we out-simplify nature itself and maybe get a peek at the raw machinery, nature's secret formula for the essence of life? Well, you and I are dense with working parts. A human cell has more than 20,000 genes, a fruit fly 13,000, a yeast cell 6,000. But, and again, I highlighted this, if we look for the simplest creatures on the planet, okay, that's important. Because again, back to Darwin's statement, if it could be shown, right? So what we're looking for to validate the theory of evolution is something so simple that it could just, and I don't even believe if it was that simple that it could move forward because of the second law of thermodynamics, but we're getting there. But let's just, evolution needs wild simplicity. So here's what he says. But if we look for the simplest creature on the planet, we will find a wee bacterium that lives happily in the digestive tracts of cows and goats called Mycoplasma mycosides. It builds itself from a very modest blueprint, only 525 genes. That's the definition of the simplest creature on the planet. A modest blueprint, only 525 genes. It's one of the simplest life forms we've ever seen. This was written in 2016. This wasn't written in 1916, right? Suggested Craig Venter 8 years ago, why not take the next step and try to engineer something even, again, remember that word engineer. Remember the word from scratch. Remember the word engineer, right? Try to engineer something even simpler. A new life form with even fewer parts. Venture is perhaps biology's most wily, most celebrated entrepreneur. He assembled an ace team of cell biologists and said, if we put our minds to it, we could strip life so bare that we would, again, create a living replicating creature with, say, only 500 genes. And I find that kind of funny. I mean, to me, going from 525 to 500 is like, why bother? I mean, They're still both pretty complicated, but that's fine. Or 400 or 300. As Chubby Checker used to sing, how low can you go? So last month we got an answer. On March 24th, Venture and his team of scientists unveiled a man-made cell. I struggle with these words. Stripped down to 473 genes. Again, I thought what was coming was we went from 525 to 8. Or something. I mean, we're trying to get simple, right? We're trying to get simple enough for something to evolve. So now we're down to 473. But listen to this. The simplest creature ever. They call it JCVI Sync 1. It's the third try of this thing. And it says, actually, it's kind of boring. It doesn't do anything magical rather than live, eat, and self-replicate. But then he says, it's the first designer organism in history. So I'm thinking, wow. These guys created life. But it's also, no one saw this coming, deeply mysterious, almost embarrassingly so. The folks who built, there's a lot of interesting words in here, this cell know it's alive. It reproduces in its laboratory dish every 3 hours. It has 473 genes, and almost every one is presumed essential. Okay, right there, do you get the connection? 473 genes, he says, in 2016, as an evolutionary biologist, are considered essential. That just, when I stand that up against Darwin's statement that if it could be shown that no complex organism, and this is a simple organism, right? They're defining this as the world's simplest organism. And he says it has 473 genes, and almost everyone is presumed essential. You cannot live without all but one or two. Then he says, that's how they built the thing. Listen to this. They started with a goat intestine. So the whole from scratch thing and man-made, I don't know how those words get in there when you started with a goat intestine. I know who made the goat intestine. I think you may have heard the joke, you know, and it's true. You know, people say, well, Paul, you believe God created the world. Where did God come from? I don't know. In the beginning, God. But you can also say, well, you believe either it came from nothing or it came from dirt. So where did the dirt come from, right? And so there's sort of a picture of, you know, God and somebody who doesn't believe that God created and saying, let's have a competition. I'll create man. God reaches down and gets some dirt, you know, and creates Adam out of the dust of the ground. The other person reaches down and goes, whoa, 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 you get your own dirt. Right? So in other words, you know, that there are some nuances in this that are big, they're important. But so again, it's all kind of like I could see God going, ho, 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 get your own goat. Don't be using the bacterium from that goat of mine. I mean, I'm amazed. I will say one thing that, you know, behind all of this and all of us is the fingerprint of God. The curiosity that this guy has to study this is the fingerprint of God on him. We are created in God's image. We are creators. The reason we like to build and design, you know, that we can talk all day long about apes and all sorts of things evolving, but you know what? There's not an animal in this world that has ever built a house or a car or a watch. Only us. You know why? Because we were created in God's image and they weren't. God made us creators. We are creative. The reason we sing songs and paint paintings and build cars and shoot rockets, no chicken has ever done that. They haven't. Beavers build dams. Yes, God designed that into them, but that's all they've ever built. Man, we get tired of dams and we want to build skyscrapers, and we do it. And we do it because of God's fingerprint, not because we are God. That's the reality. So back to this. They started with a goat intestine, copied its chemistry, booted it up, and then one by one, they looked at each and every gene and removed it. Listen to this. So they took genes and removed them. If the bacterium died, they put it back. It was necessary. If it wasn't, out it went. I just find that fascinating. Many of the genes they removed made it die. So if you rewind and say, well, how did that get there without that gene? How did that happen? Well, it couldn't. He's proving that right there. He's proving that this thing cannot live with just a few genes. He's proving it. This is an amazing article. It's a very humbling set of experiments. It's how much they don't know that's really shocking. Of the 473 genes, 324 or 68% are clearly there for housekeeping. They make proteins, protect DNA, repair the cell's membrane, the usual stuff. The usual stuff. Again, it seems so simple. You know, what goes on in our body as cells replicate. Even the DNA, RNA, I always find it fascinating, you know, that DNA alone is the instructions, but without RNA, it doesn't. It's like if you got the instructions for a grill and just the instructions, you wouldn't have a grill. You have to build the grill. You need the instructions and the grill parts. And that's how DNA and RNA work together. And, you know, it's one thing to say, well, the grill evolved. The grill, through random, just millions of years of weird stuff happening and explosions in Home Depots, the grill came to be. But to believe that, oh, by the way, the instructions for the grill in a PDF also happened by accident and they match. They're not related. They're two different things. The instructions are needed to assemble the grill, but again, it just makes it more and more, and I'm going down a slight rabbit trail, which I do not need to do today, but when we think about the complexity of just a cell, that's hard enough to understand. But here's the thing. The cell needs something to eat. as things evolve, you need all the other things that are necessary to make the thing that is quote-unquote evolving keep going is mind-boggling. We don't just need other cells. We need the entire ecosystem to survive, and it has to be there at once. The animal can't live without the ecosystem for millions of years and wait till the ecosystem gets there. It has to be there when the animal gets there. It's a big leap. Roughly 32% of the whole 149 genes have no known function. We don't know what they provide or why they're essential for life, Venter told Ira Flatlow on PRI's Science Friday. So, you know, we don't know what they do, but if we take them out, it dies, right? So anyway, Venter's team imagined that after years and years spent comparing human genomes, mouse genomes, fruit fly genomes, yeast genomes, and plant genomes, biology had a working script for what produces life. They thought they knew the basic parts, or most of them, but the truth is they didn't. The scientific community has been basically suffering from the delusion that we did know all of biology, Venter says, which is, I mean, he's being honest. This is the guy who created this thing or synthesized or whatever from the goat's belly. We truly like aliens from another planet trying to work out what these parts do. Or we're truly like aliens from another planet. Anyway, even more humbling, these unknown genes have been doing what they do for millions of years. I disagree. Or, as the biologist says, they've been conserved by evolution for some important reason. So I'm not going to read more of that, but I think it makes the point. It makes the point that life is irreducibly complex. And so let's move on. I want to show this real quickly just to show you again. This is fascinating. So if you look at the chart up here, you see that an amoeba has almost 700 billion base pairs of DNA. An amoeba, a single cell organism. We tend to talk about an amoeba, right? It's used to define the simplest thing you can get, right? Look at the man over here. So on the left is the number of a million base pairs in the genome. And I don't get this. The single cell amoeba has way more than an onion, which has more than a grasshopper, which has more than a frog, which has more than me. That's fascinating to me. Life at the cellular level is not simple. That just fascinates me. And I'm not going to read this whole slide, but I want to say this. This is interesting. The fact that humans have a smaller genome size than some amoebas, despite being far more complex, is a fascinating paradox. And I'm not going to read all those, but it says, here's why. But then it says, in humans, there is evolutionary pressure to maintain functional and efficient genome. Larger genomes could be metabolically costly and unnecessary. Natural, unguided, undirected processes do not apply pressure to anything. Pressure is applied by design constraints. Pressure is applied by design guidelines. Pressure is not applied by random whatever happens. And there's no difference in the evolution of a mouse or a human. If evolution is happening, it's just happening. It's not, there is no pressure. And then essentially, genome size isn't a measure of biological complexity. And that's true. We are more complex than an amoeba. I'm fascinated by the fact that the amoeba, I'm a little jealous, it's got a bigger genome than me. But it often reflects, listen to this, different evolutionary strategies. Natural undirected processes don't have strategies. I have strategies. They don't always work. But God had a strategy. Natural undirected processes do not have strategies. Law of thermodynamics, got to get to this. For spontaneous, I'm just going to do the second law. For spontaneous processes, that means they occur on their own. Natural, undirected, uninvolved, no design, no energy being put in. For spontaneous processes, the entropy, the amount of disorder, the measure of disorder in a system, of the universe increases. That is a law. That is a law that every evolutionary biologist will tell you they believe. Okay? Now, I think I could have just shown this slide at the beginning and it would have settled everything for everybody. I think you'll agree that pretty much when you see that, it pretty much makes pretty clear the creation claim, I think. Now, let me just say, this is a technical view of the second law of thermodynamics, and you can look at it as this. This is why your coffee gets cold if you leave it sitting. So if you ever wondered why you can't leave your coffee sitting too long, it's because of the second law of thermodynamics. Let me show you an easier picture to understand. This is another picture of the second law of thermodynamics. This process is spontaneous. It occurs on its own. So entropy of the universe increases. When entropy increases, disorder increases, okay? Air leaks from the balloon on its own. I think we can all understand that. This process is non-spontaneous. It does not occur on its own. So entropy of the universe decreases. Things get more orderly. Air never enters the balloon on its own. That's the second law of thermodynamics. You have to blow a balloon up. It will naturally deflate. That's the second law of thermodynamics. I want you to listen to this statement in light of the second law of thermodynamics. Oops, what happened? Okay. Can you make that play, Jordan? Maybe?
This is the story of a small planet in space called Earth.
For a typical Darwinian explanation of how life originated, Dr. Wells directed me toward this documentary.
The chemical elements essential for life, hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen, were now in place. What was needed was a way of combining them. Perhaps the energy came from lightning. Whatever it was.
Excuse me?
Whatever it was, energy managed to arrange these chemical ingredients in just the right way.
Okay, so again, you will find throughout evolutionary descriptions design language, right? Energy managed to arrange. Energy doesn't arrange anything. Energy is necessary. It's wildly necessary for any system to get better, to design something. But energy doesn't arrange anything in just the right way. So, you know, this idea that these elements, that energy got down there and put the puzzle together. And again, when we look at how they define the simplest life forms, you can arrange all you want, and you're not going to get anything living from that. All right, now I want you to listen to this one. Oops, okay, you're going to have to start that for me again, Jordan, sorry.
Molecules piggybacked on the back of crystals forming, and that this led to more and more complex. But of course, the nice thing about crystals is every now and then you get mistakes, mutations, and that this opens the way for natural selection.
But at one point there was not a living thing.
Yeah.
And then there was a living thing. How did that happen?
Well, this is I just told you. And I don't see any reason why you shouldn't go from very simple to more and more complex to more and more complex.
I don't either. I don't either. But I don't know how you get from mud to a living cell. That's my question.
Yes, well, I've told you.
I think it's on the back of crystals.
Try one more time.
On the backs of crystals.
On the backs of crystals is at least one hypothesis, yes.
So that's your theory, and you think that is more likely and less far-fetched than intelligent design?
I think it is.
Okay, so that man will tell you that he believes in the second law of thermodynamics. As a scientist, he will say that systems left to their own tend towards disorder. But he said, I don't see any reason why things can't get more and more and more complex, which is what's necessary for evolution. So the science favors creation wildly. It favors a creator. It just goes along with everything we know about life, that where there's a painting, there's a painter, that where there's a building, there's a builder, that where there's a design, there's a designer. That just goes together. Okay, I know I'm way over time. Super quick, I want to just mention this fossil record, Cambrian explosion. So in a perfect world, in a perfect evolutionist world, you would have layers throughout the Earth's crust and all this, and there would be very simple fossils at the bottom, and they would get more and more complex as you go up. That is not what we find. That is not what evolutionists find. They find that in the Cambrian layer, which they claim was 500 million years ago, I disagree with that. I believe that what happened in the flood was very rapid. You can look at what happened after Mount St. Helens eruption and find that things that we are told happen over thousands or millions of years can happen in days. That was proven with the St. Helens eruption in many ways. We can also find rock strata that have trees standing up in them through multiple layers, where the tree would have either had to grown through rock for millions of years, or the tree would have had to stood there for millions of years while... And again, it's obvious that those strata layers did not take millions of years to form. But the Cambrian explosion is what is referred to when all of a sudden all these complete fossils, if you see all the animalphilia, including chordate, fish, are now known as fossils in the Cambrian system. No ancestral forms can be found for all these, and I won't read all those names. These phyla appear in the fossil record fully formed and distinct. That issue, that problem, led to punctuated equilibria. In 1972, Eldridge and Gould published a paper called An Alternative to Phyletic Gradualism, and proposed that evolution is not a gradual process. When you see no evidence for a gradual process, you must explain, you must either change to a creation view, or you must find another way to explain evolution without slow gradual development. And that way was punctuated equilibrium, which claims that instead of the way Darwin initially suggested, instead there's a pattern of stasis, stability, punctuated by periods of rapid change. Okay, we're late on time. This is me. This is Paul Allen's question, which is, if evolution is happening, why did it stop? In other words, I should see weird things everywhere. I should see stuff that's half ape and half human. I should see stuff everywhere. There's no reason it would stop. Now, if apes had disappeared when they were replaced by humans, evolutionists could stand on that and say, well, you know, the survival of the fittest and all that. But apes are still here. And they apparently aren't changing into humans anymore. So, but you would expect over long periods of time that all this change would be, you'd see it everywhere. But we don't. We see very distinct species. And that's one of the problems you may have heard in that first video where he said evolution is a slippery word. Because it is true. God designed the finch. He designed the moth with the ability to adapt to its environment. There's no question about that. We see dogs, we breed dogs, but we don't breed dogs with elephants or with ferns. We breed dogs with dogs and cats with cats. And what we see all around us agrees with the biblical record of creation. It does not agree with an idea that things change slowly over time. I don't have time to go into dating assumptions. I will say this real quick. When we talk about looking at the age of the earth, and there's problems with C14 dating, there's problems, and I'll show you a quick one about ice, and then I promise I'll shut up. But when I think about Adam and Eve, imagine this. God creates Adam and Eve, and you walk up and meet him, and somebody says, how old is Adam? No one would say a day old, would you? You wouldn't. He's in his early 20s. I don't know. That tree, how old is that tree? And I don't know this, but I'll bet if you had a chainsaw and cut it down, it would have rings in it. I just believe that. I just believe that God created a world, not to deceive us, not to fool us, but he created Adam as a grown man. He created Eve as a grown woman. And I believe, the Bible doesn't tell me this. It tells me this about Abraham. It doesn't tell me it about Adam and Eve, but I still believe it, that they could see the stars. It tells me Abraham could see the stars. Well, it takes incredible amounts of time for the light to get from the star to earth. I have no problem with the fact that when God created all of it, that the light was already stretched there. That's not a problem. I just don't have a problem with that. Just like I don't have a problem with the fact that Elena painted this painting. I have no problem with that. And so that, there's problem. And so real quick, I'll end with this. There was a theory that all these ice layers represented massive amounts of time. In fact, they thought it represented about 2,000 years of accumulation until they found a World War II bomber buried in the ice below 2,000 years of ice layer. And all that tells you, and you can see this in a lot of dating things, you can see stalactites and stalagmites that appear to be very old but are hanging on the Lincoln Memorial and things like that. Again, like I say, there's so many of these things where it's not hard to believe in creation. It's easy to believe in creation. It's easy to believe in it, in the fact that we haven't been here for millions and millions of years. The time is necessary to try to make it somehow possible to believe in evolution. And it's interesting to me that even though when people open a textbook today, it'll say millions or billions of years, but that didn't prevent the Cambrian explosion problem to say, despite how many years you say there were, everything arose in this one period. So your millions and billions of years, which are going to try to soften the idea of the implausibility of gradual changes and very, very, very complex things that defy the second law of thermodynamics, they all get ended up dumped into the Cambrian time anyway. So I'm going to end with this. I didn't really make it because it's 11:32, but I'm going to end with this. This is the number one reason that I just believe that God made me. This is because I just think things made have makers. That's just what I believe. So let's close in prayer. And the worship team can come up. I'm sorry, Emily. Lord, thank you. You.